Warning, you are about to listen to the greatest radio show ever. And due to contractual obligations and to shield our airwaves and corporate licensees from any semblance of liability, responsibility, and gullibility, we must tell you the views represented on this show are not necessarily those of this station or its management. This radio show contains differing points of view on current political topics, and due to the nature of its contents, it should be heard by everyone. Thank you for listening. 3, 2, 1. Now live from the Devil Radio Studios in Madison, Wisconsin, where the political party is just beginning. Welcome to the Devil's Advocate Show. Friends proving it's never personal, only politics.
Please allow me to introduce myself.
Here is your host, Mike Crute.
And we are back. Thank you for listening to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Crudy, I can hear you, but he's got no sound, so we're going to work on that right now. I want to welcome our guest, James Santel, former U.S. Attorney. Jim, welcome back.
Man. Dom, always a delight to be with you and Mike in Madison and being right here in downtown Waukesha once again. Beautiful summer afternoon.
You know, some weeks are more crazy than others, Jim, and it just seems to get more and more and more hectic these days.
This is about an 8.9, I'd say, right? Yeah, I think so. Somewhere in the higher ends of the scale here.
Right, don't we have an election too? Right. It seems like a long time
something
ago.
Coming up in a few weeks.
Let's talk about the big news as far as I see it right off the bat. The Alan Weisselberg, the former chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, pled guilty, man. 15 felony counts. Looking at 15 years, cut a deal to do 100 days. That seems like a pretty good skate, Jim. What's he going to have to do to earn that?
Right. And so we know a lot, but we don't know many other things about how this is actually going to take place. We do know that obviously he entered a plea, which is a plea agreement between the government and him and his lawyers. Basically, he will get this lower sentence. Apparently, the judge was very much involved in this, in accomplishing all of this past week. Plainly, he has to testify. Remember that there is still another defendant in this case, and that's the Trump Organization. It's right. Not Donald Trump. It's the organization, which, as we know, is also in the ambit, the target, if you will, of the Attorney General for the state of New York. Also a defendant in this case. And so presumably that entity is still going to trial at some time. As strange as that may sound, you can bring a corporation to trial and do that. And the agreement is that he's going to testify in that context and presumably tell the truth. He's going to raise his right hand and talk about things that he knows in connection with that. That's the big element of this. There's a little bit of a fine that's going to go along with this. Plainly some supervised release afterwards. But that's the big exchange here. And plainly an awful lot of negotiation about whether or not he would testify also against a fellow named Donald John Trump. And that plainly is not happening. There was a little bit of a suggestion that he would talk a little bit about some of the notations that maybe the former president made in some of these books. But the reality is that the big thing is his testimony in connection with this upcoming trial having to do with the corporation itself.
You got to mute him. Jim Santel, fine guest. Jim, appreciate you joining us in the show, man. Very excited. I understand you're doing double duty tomorrow. Not only are you doing the morning cannolis, but my understanding is you're also sitting in on This Week in Waukesha with Don in the morning.
See what happens when you bring people together? There's conspiracies even on the radio, and they get together. They don't tell you about these things, and they say, I'm going to be on your show. You'll be on my show, and delighted to do all of that, and delighted to be with you and all your listeners tomorrow morning for 2 hours. Then the third hour right before that, from 8 to 9 on Don's show, focusing on Waukesha. We're going to talk about some political issues and presumably also about your new event tonight. At broadcasting the local sports events happening right here in Waukesha.
Careful, Jim. We'll have you doing play-by-play next Friday night.
That would be scary.
Jim said, tell our fine guest in the Waukesha studios, Jim, I got to ask you, there was no covering statement, my understanding, from the Manhattan DA's office in regards to Weisselman. Why do you think this would be the case? Typically, as I understand it, there'd be a statement saying, well, Weisselman is, covered and has pled to all of these crimes And that's an inclusive thing that would include anything not covered in specific charges.
Right.
Why does he lack for this?
Right. And so this again, it has to do with the interplay between these federal and state cases. We know that the DA is still obviously pursuing a lot there. And this is a portion of it. We recall as well that some of the DAs there left out of protest, that Donald Trump was no longer the focus of this. But I anticipate that as this goes forward, this is just breaking today, you don't want to be up there too much as the prosecutor, talking too much about the arrangement, because you never know how it's going to play out over time. We mentioned right before we were chatting here that this is all in anticipation of a trial that's still coming up, and that's going to be with respect to the corporation itself. As a DA, as a prosecutor, you don't want to be out there too much talking about that, just because, not only because your promises may not come true, but also because it tends to have an impact, if you will, even upon things like jury selection, the review of the public. And so I'm not entirely surprised there's not a huge amount of commentary about how this is going to fit into this larger scheme, if you will.
Jim, for clarity's sake, for my own edification here, is this deal requiring Weisselberg to testify in the Attorney General's case, right, or the criminal case that is also being pursued against Trump with the Manhattan DA,
right,
or both?
Right. And frankly, you know, this is going to be the subject of a lot of lawyering about this. He's plainly been given the opportunity here to testify in connection with that federal case that's out there, and that's what we're focusing on here today. The federal judge talking about all this, but very likely that this is going to have an impact upon that DA prosecution as well. And so, again, whether you're federal or state, just don't want to be out there too much talking about the interplay of these things. No doubt the federal authorities are talking with the state authorities as this goes forward. This major, major event plainly had to be, if not coordinated, at least information exchanged between those prosecution offices.
So when Weisselberg, and Creed, I'll let you go in just a second, when he says, and he's not going to testify against Donald Trump, the person, in whatever case may come, that he's decided not to do that. And for that, perhaps he'll do some of that 100 days or more. But the other side of that is, in a small organization, relatively small, the Trump Organization, I mean, you know, Donald Trump is not one to delegate lots of power, right? Presumably, Donald Trump has all sorts of signatures and all sorts of things. And, you know, I could see just the prosecutors putting up a document. Is this XYZ, and is that Donald Trump's signature, and is this criminal? Yes, yes, yes. I mean, so how does someone avoid testifying against Donald Trump, the person, when you're testifying against Donald Trump, the organization?
That is the $1 million, $1.5 million question, yeah, right? Because you can't. And again, I sort of said it tongue in cheek before. Yes, you can put a corporation on trial. There still has to be a human being there in some way to represent that corporation, quite literally sitting there in the courtroom. We don't know who that's going to be. It is so difficult, especially in these circumstances, because as we know from Michael Cohen, who talked about this as well, that Donald Trump is the organization. The organization is him. It is, as you just indicated, Dom, apparently a very closely held organization where he knows a lot about everything that's going on. He doesn't share a lot of things. And so that's going to be the fascinating part of this when this trial does happen. If, in fact, again, the corporation could plead guilty as well, that could happen too, in which case we don't get a trial out of this particular set of charges. But it does raise an awful lot of issues about how those questions are phrased. And frankly, if you're the prosecutor, while you've got to be sensitive to it, Weisselberg has now got to take the oath and testify honestly and truthfully. When you present the document that you've just identified here and say, who signed off on this? Tell me about where this came from. Who authorized this? How do you divide that out from not being a part of Donald Trump's presence there? I don't know. And I think it's going to be a great challenge for any in-trial prosecutor to sort of go back and forth and figure that out.
James, tell our fine guest, Jim, it will be Eric Trump, the personification of the Trump org, I suspect. Let me ask you, Jim, I made you a promise a long time ago, and I've never carried through on reading the Mueller report. And I've always had this excuse. It's redacted, Jim. It's redacted. And until they unredact the Mueller report, I ain't reading it. Well, are we getting closer to Crudy having a big homework assignment? And what about this newest Bill Barr and the the memo that they used to shield Trump from possible obstruction prosecution. Jim, can you explain that point a little better for layman like Rudy?
Right. So, again, a lot of this coming back again from, 2 and 3 years, and spent a lot of time chatting about this. I happen to have the Mueller report along in the studio today, Mike, for other reasons related to redaction, which have to do with something happening
out of the microphone.
There you go. And, again, I don't think it's time yet to read all 475 pages of that, but as time goes on and we have more of these prosecutions, I think your point of your question is just this. An awful lot of redactions there premised upon the notion that they were a part of an ongoing matter. Remember that? A lot of references to grand jury materials, but also ongoing matters. Even the people who are in charge of that investigation said, we can't disclose this yet because it's still an open file. As more and more of these cases come forward, it may well be that we already have some of those forward. We don't even know about it because it hasn't been redacted. Presumably, the need to continue with redaction, the thing that has frustrated you so much, begins to go away. And over time, I think it can be very appropriate to go back and say, now can we have the unredacted version of that? Even with respect to the Barr memorandum, things related to that. That's becoming historical now, right? And it's no longer as timely, no longer has the impact upon investigations that it may have had at the time that we first came to know about it.
Jim, it was always quite convoluted, not because it wasn't clear that there was criminality, not because it wasn't clear that there was probably obstruction of justice on behalf of Trump, but because it was hard for the American people to understand, Jim. Yes. It was a complicated crime or a complicated allegation being made. And Mueller was perhaps not the greatest communicator. Do you think these perhaps soon-to-be alleged crimes, these indictments that I think inevitably will come down against Donald Trump, are you worried about what's contained in the Mueller report still, or are the pressing potential indictments more important? You know, let's say something around the insurrectionist line, Jeff.
Right. I think those are the more important thing now. And again, at the time, the redactions might have been important to preserve those. But now as we go forward, more of this, once you have indicted someone, once you've charged something in federal court, in state court, wherever you are, that becomes a part of the public record. And so my own sense is a lot of those things that were redacted, not a part of the public record, can be disclosed. Discovery, they will be disclosed in court.
He is James Santel, our good friend, former U.S. attorney, the host of Morning Cannolis right here on Saturday mornings, also appearing on This Week in Waukesha tomorrow morning with Don Brown. And I understand he'll be doing high school football next week. More Devil's Advocates coming back with James Santel in the Shaw, Crudy in Wisconsin Rapids, Evan in the world headquarters, you on the phone perhaps as well.
Devil's Advocates, radio for the 99%.
And we are back. Thank you for listening to the Devil's Advocates radio show. James Santel, former U.S. attorney, friend of ours, sticking around for the happy hour. Jim, always a pleasure to talk to you, man. I've been thinking about you all week, baby.
It's been a good and exciting week in American politics and history, too. Your grandchildren will be talking about what happened this week, I think, readily down the road here.
Jim, with so many potential prosecutions of the former president, let's rank them in the order that we would like to see happen. Let me ask you, the raid of Mar-a-Lago, apparently triggered by Trump's having classified documents at the beach house, some of which may have included some nuclear secrets. And apparently he was subpoenaed back in the month of February, my understanding from the reporting I've seen, and he didn't comply with the subpoenas. So eventually the FBI came looking for the classified documents. Apparently there might have been an inside informant. I'm thinking either Melania or Ivanka. But anyways, Joe, are these still paperwork crimes, as I've described them a few times this week, relative to the perhaps alleged or indictments for interfering in the Georgia election or insurrection against the vice president, the Constitution, Jim? If you had to rank the order of what's the the worst crime, what would you like to see prosecuted first?
I would buy into your ranking, which is when you pull all this back, right? This is the hot topic this week. It's a big deal, right? That we are searching a federal search warrant of the home of a former president. Once again, the word unprecedented, much too used, but used appropriately because we've never done this before. It's a big story, but in the end, when you look at this, and I do not mean in any way to minimize the seriousness of this document case, taking materials out, the three statutes set forth in the covering memorandum, the covering item, if you will, for the search warrant, all alleging felonies. They're all very serious matters. In the end, things related to the Georgia matter, that is calling up and seeking 11,780 votes, doing things related to January 6th and the insurrection there, all of that in time when this dies down a little bit, those are much more serious. And frankly, if I were the Attorney General right now and had to rank them, and you don't necessarily have to do that yet, but those would be the ones that I would put at the top of the list and not these others. Again, not because they're not important, but just because in the broad scope of things, what goes to the, you know, fundamental about the rule of law in America? Can you imagine anything more important than ensuring that elective politics are properly conducted and that we count votes in the Congress when in fact they represent truly what Americans had voted about?
I get it. That's very important, but I have an issue with Crudy's characterization of paperwork crimes if we've right. argued about this in the past. But if, and we don't know what the deal was, but Donald Trump was not hanging on these documents, presumably, for a memento, for something to hang on the wall, right? There is value from these documents that he would want to squeeze out one way, shape, or form. And if those documents ever were to be, I don't know, you know, copied and given over to, say, the Saudis, who then maybe would give, you know, Jared and his family, you know, a couple $1 billion for a fund that he has no idea what he's doing, have never done something like that before. I mean, these are very specific. Now, we're not there yet, but a ex-president holding on and maybe trying to, you know, sell some classified documents, that'd be pretty bad, right?
Be huge. And to your point, the very statutes that are cited in the authorization for the warrant describe just that. They describe the kinds of things. Are you compromising the defense of the United States of America, national security interests? Yeah, they talk about some of those paper things, just disclosures and mutilation and destruction of documents. But ultimately, they get to those fundamental issues. And if you think about it, let's suppose at some point Donald Trump and maybe others are indicted for this particular event. You've taken documents. You are not entitled to them. You've taken them, moved them to your private residence. The theory of the prosecution can't be, if it's going to be successful, just that you've done this paper movement, right?
Period.
You've got to come up with a motive for it, right? And so I think that's the all-important question that could raise this to a much higher level, could also impact on the extent to which the Attorney General says, I'm going to prosecute this one as opposed to another one. If there is evidence, and as you said, we are not there yet.
Right.
We are not there yet. If there is evidence that the intent to sell, to give some of this information to some of our enemies or even not our enemies, to use it in a way for his own economic gain, his own political gain, then you've got an entirely different story. Then you're coming closer once again to real corruption at the highest levels here.
But that has not been alleged yet.
It has not
and
been alleged.
I get the whole concept of quid pro quo. I learned a lot of it from you, sir, in regards to the first impeachment trial. But that is not what's being alleged here. And if you only get one bite at the apple, and I think you only really get one crack at prosecuting Donald Trump. I mean, you do. You better make it stick. If you're coming after the king, you better.
The guy's being investigated in multiple states and on multiple issues on a federal level. How do you go and pick only one?
This is Merrick Garland's tremendous challenge right now. I mean, again, we can list all of them. He doesn't have to be as concerned about the state prosecutions, the DA's prosecution we just chatted about in the Weisselberg matter, Letitia James, Fannie Willis in Georgia. He's got to communicate with those folks, but he has got enough on his plate just federally. He's got to pick and choose at some point, maybe not to the exclusion of others, but he does have to identify some core prosecution elements, if you will, and make it not so complicated that a jury or even several juries can't comprehend this. It cannot be so broad that you lose the forest for the trees, quite literally.
Well, Jim, I want this, whatever it is, eventually that the former president is convicted and sentenced for. I want it to be a life sentence, effectively. I don't want it to be, you know, 100 days. I don't want it to be 3 months in Rikers, although that would be disastrous. I mean, Trump could never live 3 months in Rikers. But I want to see 30 years in the federal pen, because I think the underlying, the real crimes, Jim, not the paperwork crimes, although it would be substantially a bigger crime if he sold it to Russia or something, but that's not yet been alleged. But the greater crimes is the insurrection against the government, against the Constitution. It's hang Mike Pence. I think, Jim, that is the crime that history needs to convict Donald Trump for, right, and send his ass to prison for the rest of his life.
And a lot of that will be above the sentencing guidelines when it comes to that, where you get those higher sentences based upon the nature of the offense conduct that has been convicted. That's where you get those very large sentences, 20 and 30 years. The smaller items, again, you may in fact get the months or years in prison, but not the kind of dramatic sentence you're talking about.
I'm pretty sure Melania is going to say no conjugal visits. Jim Santel, thanks a lot for coming down. I got to sneak off to a high school football game, Nacoosa. Listen tonight on WIRI in Nacoosa, 105.5 FM. Also kicking off high school football in Waukesha and Wausau tonight, all across the Civic Media dial. Jim, you and Dom, you guys.
We will continue.
I got to go.
Oh, we got it. We got it. Folks, come back with us. We're the Devil's Advocates, 844-967-2789.
I met this lawyer, we went out to dinner, I had the lobster bisque, we went back to my place, yada, yada, yada. I never heard from him again.
The Devil's Advocates, rock and roll political commentary in a top 40 world.
And we are back. Thank you for listening to the Devil's Advocates radio show. It's a Friday. We air the grievances, but I am not aggrieved at this very moment. Our good friend, James Santel, former U.S. attorney, friend of ours, going to stick around for the rest of the hour. Thank you, Jim. Always a pleasure, man.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Dom. Glad to be with you.
We're talking a lot of redaction. Redaction in the news. I mean, good redaction, bad redaction. This redaction, you got to unredact. We're going to redact this, review it. Maybe we'll see what happens.
A whole new verb for him
Lots of redaction going on. So let's stick with the topic of the raid on Mar-a-Lago on these sensitive documents, let's call it. The judge has now ordered the prosecutors to go back and they want to release as much information, quote unquote, as possible from the affidavit. And of course, this is not standard operating procedure, Jim.
It is not.
Have you ever seen something like this happen in all the years you practice?
Someone can prove me wrong by identifying that case, but I can't remember a single one, and I don't know of other prosecutors, federal or state, where this would have happened. Why? Number one, we are presumably still early in this investigation, believe it or not. We've just gotten these documents. Now we have to figure out what they mean. Presumably they've got lots and lots of them to take a look at. In my history, I don't recall any successful petition. I don't recall a number of petitions even being made by defense counsel for this. When someone is charged, and that's a very important point here, nobody has been charged with an offense under any of those statutes yet. That may well happen, probably months, hopefully not years from now, but months from now. And when that happens, then that gets produced as a part of discovery. We may well see that affidavit in the context of a trial on those charges. But I would offer that this is wildly premature, and more important, certainly, as much as we adore and embrace the media out there and the need for public information, I would offer that the need for an integrity-filled investigation and prosecution is greater than that. Maybe only slightly, but greater than that. You don't want to compromise in some way the possibility of getting a conviction down the road based upon the fact that here in late August of 2022, we're just all interested in finding out what that thing really says.
Right.
That's the problem. And so I was surprised, like many other people, you hit it right in the head, Dom, that many other people who sort of, I like to think we know a little bit about this, looked at this and said, oh, the judge is not going to buy into this. He's going to say, no, let's do what we normally do. He didn't. And as you said, he said, well, the public has a right to this much information just described, and directed the Department of Justice to go back and redact this. They've got to get their homework in by Thursday, I understand. Fascinating process right now. So what do? You go back and you try to get rid of all those things that identify who these witnesses are, and even not just their names, but the things that they knew, how they knew it. A lot of this has to do with their credibility. How do we know that Jim Santel is reliable when he says these things? That's huge paragraphs of stuff. And the minute you don't redact that, you identify the person, even if not by name. So I think, once again, you're right. This is going to be a redaction, at least offered by the department, that's going to leave maybe headings, as we saw in the Mueller report, maybe some table of contents aspects of it. But beyond that, not a whole lot. And then the question is that really worth it? Is it really worth it to produce something that's got black ink all over it?
And the judge will make that determination. Because the judge, obviously, I mean, signed off on this. The judge knows knows what's in it.
He knows well what's
so
in it.
So they're going to do their homework, going to come back Thursday. They're going to say all this stuff's blacked out, and the judge will make that determination at that point, whether that's good or there should be more redactions or less redactions. And is this the only stab that the prosecutors get at doing this?
It would not be. Again, they can probably argue with him. Even if he says, listen, this is what I'm planning to do. It could even be an in-camera proceeding. And they'd say, well, I'm going to release this page. He could go back and forth and maybe file some memorandum, say, no, judge, here's the reason why that particular thing that you're thinking of releasing is problematic. If in the end it is a court document, it's something authorized by the court, even though it's generated by the executive branch, the Department of Justice. If in the end the Department of Justice is so dissatisfied, and they could well be if this judge does disclose, I still don't think he will, but if he does disclose more that they want, they can then appeal that decision. And I'm fairly certain that the judge in this case has Bruce Reinhardt. He's a magistrate judge, to be very clear, not a Title III judge in the Constitution. He has said that he would stay his order, whatever that is, to let anybody appeal his decision. That would go to the D.C. Court of Appeals right there in the District of Columbia. My guess is that a three-judge panel there would probably toe the line fairly carefully on history here and say, nope, we're going to follow the norm here and not disclose
anything.
And
these are the media outlets that are asking for
it. These are the media outlets, absolutely, are asking for it. Significantly, Donald Trump, I'm told, reliably by the media, that in the context of this hearing, the attorneys for Donald Trump were notably silent again, because this is a double-edged sword, right? On the one hand, you might say, well, gee, it'll show these outrageous conduct, this behavior by the department, or not. And also, by the way, if the judge, and he won't do this, but if it does disclose a lot about what this is all about, that's not helpful to the president, in the same way that when this charge comes out, if in fact it does, if at some point there is a discreet prosecution for this, that indictment will probably be something of a talking indictment.
Then it's
all out there.
Yeah, but it's also from a PR perspective. I mean, Donald Trump could have released the search warrant. They had access to that. Right. He didn't. And there's I speculate that he did not, because if you release it, you can't fundraise off it, right? So he's in grift / defense mode. You got to make some money because you're going to be spending some money.
Right.
But if the timeline, for example, it was known recently, not known before, that a subpoena was issued earlier in May or the spring.
Right, June.
And there's back and forth, presumably, between Trump's attorneys and the DOJ. I mean, those kinds of things that are generally out in public now, they could put a detail, the specifics of that without revealing anything else, right? So there could be things that could come out that would make Donald Trump look really bad and blow up his entire framing of grift on this, and yet not reveal any pertinent information.
And that you could do, because what does that go to? That doesn't go so much to the probable cause at the site. That goes to the history of getting that information.
How we got to that point.
Yeah. And so again, Department of Justice policy, the first thing is you ask nicely. You write a letter and you say, listen, we think the president
has... Do you
has
though, Jim? Come on, if I got nuclear secrets, are they going to send me a letter, man?
Right. And it may well be that you heighten that an awful lot, because within moments after sending that letter and you get a response back saying, we've gotten nothing. We know that some of his attorneys in June said nothing at all. Plainly, those attorneys may also be in some bar trouble
down the road, right?
if they made some knowing misrepresentations. But again, policy normally, absent the nuclear aspect, which is huge to carve out here, would be we're asking you to produce this material. You don't get back to us in a fairly timely fashion. Then we're going to issue a grand jury subpoena, which they did, coming out of the grand jury, which was investigating something here. And then when that still doesn't produce what you want, that's when you go in with the unilateral search warrant. Nothing wrong with it. That's the way the process works. But you do that kind of tri-step approach. That's what is very uncomfortable for Donald Trump and his people to look at. Your point about it does tend to undermine his notion that, hey, nothing to hide here, or I've got all these other theories about why it is I was confused, or he's had plenty of time
to produce.
And so that portion of it, again, not that's the procedural, that's the process that gets you here. If that's inside the affidavit, and it may well be, just to establish for the magistrate judge, listen, we're not just going in to beat down his door in the first instance. We tried. Nothing happened here. And now we're doing the final thing. This is last resort time. That could be there, and that could be released without compromising.
Well, we tried and he lied, and they eventually got the closed circuit cameras, and they saw something presumably that they didn't like that was very concerning to them. So they went and made a point to get that information. Folks, we're the Devil's Advocates. That's James Santel, former U.S. attorney, talking, of course, the raid on Mar-a-Lago. Let me ask you a layman question. What if they come across, you know, other things while they're doing this search that could be, you know, potentially criminal? Do you scoop it all up? I mean, if you found a kilo of cocaine and, you know, a couple of people tied up in the basement, I mean, how does the FBI address other potential, maybe not so obviously potential criminal activity, but other potential activity? What happens in those circumstances?
Right, and this is where we're opening the law school again this afternoon, right? This is exactly what we talk about all the time in criminal constitutional procedure, criminal law, basically. And the answer is that the authorizing document, the search warrant itself, in this case, it's very broad. It talks about a mansion. It talks about all the rooms, talks about the 45 office, and basically says you can search pretty much the entire estate. The only thing that carves out, interestingly, is, if there are residents there, people are paying to stay there, stay out of their rooms because there's probably nothing there. This is a very broad commission.
Unless they're the Saudis,
right? And that goes to your point, which is, let us suppose that under this broad commission from the judge, go in, you can seize anything. There's a second attachment that describes what it is you can seize, and it's pretty broad as well. Documents and materials, communications about even destroying documents, that's all there. Suppose you get there, and again, this is hypothetical. I'm not indicating that this was the case, but you get there, and then you discover, for example, that there is my infamous, you know, methamphetamine lab going on, or there is some other sort of bank fraud.
Yeah, Bannon was hanging out for the weekend. Right? You never know. Right?
All kinds of things. The answer is that certainly if it's in plain view, if you have scooped it up in the territory, the venue that you already have authorization to get documents in, you can take it. If it's in plain view, it's there. If there's a separate special portion, for example, of a particular site, a shed, frankly, I was interested to see that there is a safe here as well that they went into.
Yeah.
Typically, we'd go back, the agents would call in and say, hey, Jim, we've got we found a special room here. We don't have authorization to go in there. Should we get probable cause and go in? And the answer would be yes, we'd go back and get that again. Here, I don't see that because it's so incredibly broad. And the only restriction then would be about location. If there's really something, I don't think you can go in and dig up in the back garden, for example, and do other things. But it's very, very broad in terms of where they went. Even getting into this safe, under normal circumstances, agents call back and say, hey, we found a safe here. I would go back to the judge and say, now we found a safe.
They knew the safe was there.
They knew the safe was there.
Yeah, they knew ahead of time.
Exactly. And it goes back to our other issue, which is whoever is providing information, maybe more than one person, said, not only have I seen documents there, but, oh, by the way, there is a safe. And again, the probable cause to get into the safe would be, I have seen documents in the safe or things deposited into that safe. It's got to be that specific. This is called particularity, specificity of the search. And so it's very broad here because the judge made it that way. And secondarily, if there's some concerns about getting into other areas that are not specifically authorized, you can still do that. We often spend a lot of time as prosecutors defending those kinds of broad seizures. But if it's in the ambit of the authorization given, usually it comes in. Every so often it's excluded, but I don't think it's going to be excluded in this particular case.
Jim, we've speculated, and I have speculated, that, and I don't believe Donald Trump would keep documents like this just for the hell of it, and that there's some, you know, monetary or some value that he's trying to, you know, glean from these documents. If we look at the current charge of 763, 793, something like that, as they go through this investigation, if I have the suspicion, though I have no proof, that Trump is a dirty mofo and he's trying to, you know, sell these things for money. That's just me talking on the radio. But obviously the DOJ and people with evidence and facts have to go through that. What would need to be available for suspicion of kind of that activity to... And what would need to be shown to the DOJ to move an investigation like this from where it's at into something that would be more than a paperwork crime?
Moving it from the Mike side of the aisle to the Dom side of the aisle, right?
Exactly.
And so all kinds of things could happen. Again, I'd go back to the human aspects of this, right? The same people who are telling you where those documents are can probably tell you, maybe not all about the meetings or discussions, but these documents happen to be on the top of Donald Trump's desk there in his 45 office. Oh, these were in a box in the back of the closet. I was there, for example, when he had a conversation conversation with somebody and said, hey, look at this. Isn't this interesting? That human aspect, the Weisselberg thing, if you will, the guy who was in the room when it happened. If you've got those witnesses, another reason not to disclose them right now in the context of the affidavit, those people are going to be able to give you some insight into how those documents were used, what kinds of things the former president may have said. And then you also just look to where they are located, as I say, if they are atop of a desk, if there are other places.
What if they're copied and scanned and already, if their paper can be copied, man. Right. I mean, that's very concerning. How do we know what they've done with these documents for the last year and a half? Jim, we're going to have to hold there. One more segment with our fine guest, James Santel, former U.S. attorney. The other redaction story, the Mueller report. Apparently, the conversations that went on during the DOJ investigation, or the special Robert Mueller investigation, well, Barr and his cronies, his lieutenants, they had conversations about obstruction. Jim, I know you had an issue with the lack of charges on the obstruction. Maybe we'll get to see some of that. We're going to talk about that next. Folks, we're the Devil's Advocates, 844-967-2789.
FBI, open up! It's over. Nothing matters anymore.
And nothing else matters.
Some great stuff.
The Devil's Advocates, the fix for political junkies everywhere.
And we are back. Thank you for listening to the Devil's Advocates radio show. Happy Friday to us all. Last segment of the day, James Santel, former U.S. attorney, our guest to the top of the hour. Jim, thank you so much for sticking around, man.
Always a pleasure to be with you, my friend.
The time flies so fast. There's so many things to talk about, and I certainly appreciate you spending the time with us, not just today, but certainly over the years, Jim. It's always been fun. So let's talk about Bill Barr, your former boss, right?
Absolutely. He was for a time. The first incarnation of Bill Barr was my tenure. Again, not to defend my past indication when he started, he would be a wonderful attorney general, which again proved not to be the case. I'm willing to acknowledge that publicly. First time around, he was much more of an institutional guy. I'll leave it just to that. We can talk about other things down the road here. Yeah.
Okay, so Bill Barr, and he had the opportunity to, as they were looking at this Mueller investigation, two parts, the Russian collusion and, of course, the obstruction of justice. Seemed like a slam dunk case. They apparently deliberated internally and decided not to release any documents and said nothing to see here. We can't prove it. But now today, a federal appeals court has ordered the release of that memo, discussing whether Trump obstructed the investigation into the Russian interference. It was a unanimous panel decision. Jim, I know you took great umbrage with the fact that he was not and had not been and will not be now due to statutes of limitations charged with obstruction in that case. But what does this mean for the rest of us for history, Jim?
Sure. And again, to go back to that very point, I think we're just about at the point where all those things that Bob Mueller identified that were in fact obstruction, to make it one last time, they may put this to bed finally on a Friday afternoon in August. If you and I were to have done those things, if we were in those similar circumstances, you may be certain you would have been charged, convicted, and sentenced. And so that's the frustration with this. When history looks back on this, I think people will say, gee, I'm reading this Mueller report. The Russia stuff, okay, maybe not quite as compelling, although it's there too. But the obstruction justice stuff is pretty, pretty compelling. Why wasn't there not a charge? We know the history, and that gets to today's issue, which is Bob Mueller comes out and says, first of all, nothing to see here. He writes this letter that basically summarizes.
Bill Barr.
Bill Barr, yes. Right? Exactly. Yeah, Bill Barr comes out and says, nothing to see here. I've looked at this. He reads it very, very quickly after it's released by the Mueller folks and says there's nothing there. The morning, you remember the morning that you and I were on the radio,
yes,
right
I
here,
do.
And trying to read through this very quickly. He has another press conference in which he once again reiterates trying to create this narrative that there is, as you just said, nothing to see here.
He was successful in doing so.
He was successful in doing so. And with all due respect to the other party and other folks out there, partisan and non, did not not do a good job of pushing back. Admittedly, part of this is, as Mike was just saying, it's a couple hundred pages. It's hard to push back when it's that thick, and that's, I get that completely. On the other hand, plainly told the American public a story that was not true, not an accurate representation. I think Bob Mueller himself, admittedly not the crisp and a very acute guy that he was early in his career, also acknowledged that representation in that letter, those things that Barr said, were not accurate. And so today, we're going to get from as a result of this appeals court panel saying, no, release the background to all that. We're going to get the background backstory on the deliberation about that. We're going to find out what exactly, who said what to the Attorney General at the
time. There's no deliberation,
right,
Jim. We know this already, right? I mean, and what if we find out that there was no deliberation? It was always that way. They were always going to come out with that position.
Right.
What then?
Right. And that is the question now for history, right? Because as you indicated, the statute of limitations, there may be a few lingering counts there that could be charged into next year, but pretty much March, April, May, June, July, August of 2017, we're 5 years beyond that.
Are
now,
any of those folks that they would have, quote unquote, deliberated about these charges still at the FBI? Or are you talking about
the FBI, main justice, too. Remember, these are decisions made across the street at 9th and Constitution there. Presumably you've got some civil servants who are there, and they I'm sure they are still there. You probably have an awful lot of political people who are no longer there, who are at the top levels of the AG's staff at that time. That's the way it is for any administration, including this present administration. They're still around. They're still out there in any event. And maybe the one thing you can do, whether you are a freelance journalist or someone who's got the power of a New York Times behind you, is to track some of them down and say, you know what? Now it appears that you said this about that account of the obstruction. Justify this. Explain this away. And again, nothing you can do. There's nothing about...
You can shame them?
You can shame them. Maybe that's what we're left with, because once again,
man,
we didn't do the thing that we should have done. We should have done 4 and 5 years ago, which would have been, again, at the time, not to indict him because of the memorandum, but you look down Capitol Hill, you should have been impeached on those issues, right?
The OLC is a bunch of bunk anyway. You can absolutely should indict him. That's never been challenged. And that's one of the reasons why we're in the position that we are. And when you have in my opinion, if this comes out, and it seems to me that you basically have what, Bill Barr, the Attorney General of the United States of America, obstructing justice of a report of the president obstructing justice.
Right. You've got double obstruction here going on, right?
I mean, Barr gets away with it, Trump gets away with it, and we're all supposed to sit here and just, what, hold hands and say, well, we'll try better next time?
And to your point, the civics point is just this. That is a memorandum inside the Department of Justice. You're absolutely right. Never been tested in a court. And, you know, frankly, other things that this attorney general, our future attorney general, could do to correct history, if this happens again, and may well in our lifetimes, let's rescind that memorandum. Random.
Absolutely.
If in fact Bob Mueller is true when he says in the last words of Mueller report, no one is above the law. And what does he quote? He quotes Nixon versus United States. If that means something, then you know what? If you're in the White House, you're at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and you do something that is criminal, you should be responsible for it in the past, in the present, and in the future. That has to be rescinded. Your point is very well taken.
Just like you, just like me, Jim.
Right.
Just a couple minutes left. I want to roll back briefly, if I may, to New York Attorney General Tish James on the civil case against Donald Trump. There's so many angles coming at him. Is she able, if given the evidence to prove it, is it her responsibility? Can she bring criminal charges against Trump and or the organization aside from this civil case if during this case, you know, Weisselberg says it implicates the Trump organization in something criminal.
Right. And so the answer is her jurisdiction is principally, if not predominantly, civil in New York.
Right.
And so that's what she's pursuing right now. That's a significant thing. Remember, she shut down Trump University.
Yes.
She jumped on the foundation. So this is no small thing, going after the entire corporation, the organization.
But is she blocked from bringing criminal case again?
She would be under her jurisdiction, but what can she do? She can send it across Foley Square and say, Mr. District Attorney Alvin Bragg, I've got this additional information here. Charge this. Again, he can charge in the state statutes.
Do you think he's sandbagging? What's your impression on Bragg? Last 20 seconds.
Right. And, you know, I'm disappointed by the fact, I'm concerned about the fact we have these DAs who left and said, you know what, we had a case here. Concerned about that. I haven't looked inside the entire file. I don't know for sure. I think there's a concern there. there about being sufficiently aggressive in a situation like this.
We are aggressive when we have to be. James Santel, former U.S. attorney, friend of ours. Thank you, Jim. Always a pleasure.
Always
man.
A delight to be with you, Don.
Have a wonderful weekend. Folks, you have a wonderful weekend as well. Thank you, Evan. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Crudy. Good luck tonight calling those games. We're the Devil's Advocates. We'll be back on Monday. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Good. He's not gone. That's the whole point.
This is what you
He's
do.
Never gone.
Is just
well, history is so written by the winner, so it largely depends on who's writing the history.
Right,
the bit snitty. Right.